This is Audible.
And now, part 3 of The Best Science Fiction of the Year, Volume 1. Edited by Neil Clark and performed by Jeremy Arthur and Amy Talmadge. Carter Shoals published his first story in 1977, in Damon Knight's Orbit. His first novel, Palimpsests, with Glenn Harcourt, appeared as one of Terry Carr's ace specials, and his other books include Radiance, The Amount to Carry, Kafka Americana, with Jonathan Lethem, and Gypsy. Carter has been a finalist for Hugo, Nebula, and Campbell Awards. He is also active as a musician and composer. His work is available from Frog Peak Music. He currently lives in Northern California. Gypsy. Carter Shoals. The living being is only a species of the dead, and a very rare species. Nietzsche. When a long shot is all you have, you're a fool not to take it. Romany saying. For Cheryl. 1. The launch of Earth's first starship went unremarked. The crew gave no interviews. No camera broadcast the hard light pulsing from its tail. To the plain eye, it might have been a common airplane. The media battened on multiple wars and catastrophes. The Arctic Ocean was open sea. Florida was underwater. Crises and opportunities intersected. World population was something over 10 billion. No one was really counting anymore. A few billion were stateless refugees. A few billion more were indentured or imprisoned. Oil reserves, declared as recently as 2010 to exceed a trillion barrels, proved to be an accounting gimmick, gone by 2020. More difficult and expensive sources, tar sands in Canada and Venezuela, natural gas fracking, became primary, driving up atmospheric methane and the price of fresh water. The countries formerly known as the Third World stripped and sold their resources with more ruthless abandon than their mentors had. With the proceeds, they armed themselves. The U.S. was no longer the global hyperpower, but it went on behaving as if. Generations of outspending the rest of the world combined had made this its habit and brand. Arms merchant to expedient allies, former and future foes alike, starting or provoking conflicts more or less at need, its constant need being, as always, resources. Its waning might was built on a memory of those vast native reserves it had long since expropriated and depleted, and a sense of entitlement to more. These overseas conflicts were problematic and carried wildly unintended consequences. As the president of Venezuela put it just days before his assassination, "It's dangerous to go to war against your own asshole." The starship traveled out of our solar system at a steep angle to the ecliptic plane. It would pass no planets. It was soon gone. Going south. Sophie. 2043. Trying to rise up out of the cold, sinking back into a dream of rising up out of the... Stop. Stop it now. Shivering. So dark. So thirsty. Mama? Help me? Her parents were wealthy. They had investments, a great home. They sent her to the best schools. They told her how privileged she was. She'd always assumed this meant she would be okay forever. She was going to be a poet. It was breathtaking how quickly it went away. All that okay. Her dad's job, the investments, the college tuition, the house. In 2 years, like so many others, they were penniless and living in their car. She left unfinished her thesis on Louis Zukovsky's last book, 80 Flowers. She changed her major to information science, slept with a loan officer, finished grad school half a million in debt, and immediately took the best-paying job she could find at Zocket Defense Systems, librarian. She hadn't known that defense contractors hired librarians. They were pretty much the only ones who did anymore. Her student loan was adjustable rate, the only kind offered. As long as the rate didn't go up, she could just about get by on her salary. Best case, she'd have it paid off in 30 years. Then the rate doubled. She lost her apartment. XDS had huge dorms for employees who couldn't afford their own living space. Over half their workforce lived there. It was indentured servitude. Yet she was lucky, lucky. If she'd been a couple of years younger, she wouldn't have finished school at all. She'd be fighting in Burma or Venezuela or Kazakhstan. At XDS, she tended the library's firewalls, maintained and documented software, cataloged projects, fielded service calls from personnel who needed this or that right now, or had forgotten a password, or locked themselves out of their own account. She learned Unix, wrote cron scripts and daemons and Perl routines. There was a satisfaction in keeping it all straight. She was a serf. But they needed her, and they knew it. And that knowledge sustained in her a hard, small sense of freedom. She thought of Zhukovsky, teaching for 20 years at Brooklyn Polytech. It was almost a kind of poetry, the vocabulary of code. Chirping. Birds? Were there still birds? No. Tinnitus. Her ears ached for sound in this profound silence. Created their own. She was a California girl, an athlete, a hiker, a climber. She'd been all over the Sierra Nevada, had summited 4 14,000-footers by the time she was 16. She loved the backcountry, loved its stark beauty, solitude, the life that survived in its harshness, the pikas, the marmots, the mountain chickadees, the heather and white-bark pine and polymonium. After joining XDS, it became hard for her to get to the mountains. Then it became impossible. In 2035, the Keep Wilderness Wild Act shut the public out of the national parks, the national forests, the BLM lands. The high country above timberline was surveilled by satellites and drones, and it was said that mining and fracking operators would shoot intruders on sight, and that in the remotest areas, like the Enchanted Gorge and the Muro Blanco, lived small nomadic bands of malcontents. She knew enough about the drones and satellites to doubt it. No one on Earth could stay hidden anywhere for more than a day. The backcountry, she mourned, was all Earth to her. To lose it was to lose all Earth, and to harden something final inside her. One day Roger Fry came to her attention. Perhaps it was the other way round, poking in her stacks where he didn't belong. That was odd. The login and password had been validated. The clearance was the highest. There was no place in the stacks prohibited to this user. Yet her alarms had tripped. By the time she put packet sniffers on it, he was gone. In her email was an invitation to visit a website called Gypsy. When she logged in, she understood at once. It thrilled her and frightened her. They were going to leave the planet. It was insane. Yet she felt the powerful seduction of it. How starkly its plain insanity exposed the greater consensus insanity the planet was now living. That there was an alternative. She sat up on the slab, slowly unwrapped the Mylar bodysuit, disconnected one by one its drips and derms and stents and catheters and Waldos and sensors, let it drift crinkling to the floor. Her breathing was shallow and ragged. Every few minutes she gasped for air and her pulse raced. The temperature had been raised to 20 degrees Celsius as she came to, but still she shivered. Her body smelled a way it had never smelled before, like vinegar and nail polish. It looked pale and flabby, but familiar. After she'd gathered strength, she reached under the slab, found a sweatshirt and sweatpants, and pulled them on. There was also a bottle of water. She drank it all. The space was small and dark and utterly silent. No ports, no windows. Here and there, on flat black walls, glowed a few pods of LEDs. She braced her hands against the slab and stood up, swaying. Even in the slight gravity, her heart pounded. The ceiling curved gently away a hand's breadth above her head, and the floor curved gently upward. Unseen beyond the ceiling was the center of the ship, the whole of the donut, and beyond that the other half of the slowly spinning torus. Twice a minute it rotated, creating a centripetal gravity of 1/10 g. Any slower would be too weak to be helpful. Any faster, gravity would differ at the head and the feet enough to cause vertigo. Under her was the outer ring of the water tank, then panels of aerogel sandwiched within sheets of hydrogenous carbon composite, then a surrounding jacket of liquid hydrogen tanks, and then interstellar space. What had happened? Why was she awake? Look, over 70-plus years, systems will fail. We can't rely on auto repair. With a crew of 20, we could wake one person every few years to perform maintenance.
And put them back under? Hibernation is dicey enough without trying to do it twice.
Yes, it's a risk. What's the alternative?
What about failsafes? No one gets wakened unless a system is critical. Then we wake a specialist. A steward.
That could work.
She walked the short distance to the ship's console and sat. It would have been grandiose to call it a bridge. It was a small desk bolted to the floor. It held a couple of monitors, a keyboard, some pads. It was like the light and sound booth of a community theater. She wished she could turn on more lights. There were no more. Their energy budget was too tight. They had a fission reactor on board, but it wasn't running. It was to fire the nuclear rocket at their arrival. It wouldn't last 72 years if they used it for power during their cruise. Not far from her, nothing on the ship was far from her, were some 50 kilograms of plutonium pellets, not the PU-239 of fission bombs, but the more energetic PU-238. The missing neutron cut the isotope's half-life from 25,000 years to 88 years and made it proportionately more radioactive. That alpha radiation was contained by iridium cladding and a casing of graphite, but the pellet still gave off heat, many kilowatts worth. Most of that heat warmed the ship's interior to its normal temperature of 4 degrees Celsius. Enough of it was channeled outwards to keep the surrounding water liquid in its jacket, and the outer tanks of hydrogen at 14 kelvins, slush, maximally dense. The rest of the heat ran a Stirling engine to generate electricity. First, she read through the protocols, which she had written. Steward's logs to be read by each wakened steward. Kept in the computers, with redundant backups, but also kept by hand, ink on paper, in case of system failures, a last-chance critical backup. And because there is something restorative about writing by hand. There were no steward's logs. She was the first to be wakened. They were only 2 years out. Barely into the Oort cloud. She felt let down. What had gone wrong so soon? All at once, she was ravenous. She stood, and the gravity differential hit her. She steadied herself against the desk, then took 2 steps to the storage bay. 3/4 of the ship was storage. What they would need at the other end. What Roger called pop-up civilization. She only had to go a step inside to find a box of MREs. She took 3, stepped out, and put 1 into the microwave. The smell of it warming made her mouth water and her stomach heave. Her whole body trembled as she ate. Immediately she put a 2nd into the microwave. As she waited for it, she fell asleep. She saw Roger. What must have happened to him after that terrible morning when they received his message? Go. Go now. Go at once. He was wearing an orange jumpsuit, shackled to a metal table.
How did you think you could get away with it, Fry?
I did get away with it. They've gone.
But we've got you.
That doesn't matter. I was never meant to be aboard.
Where are they going?
Alpha Centauri.
He would pronounce it with the hard K.
That's impossible.
Very likely. But that's where they're going.
Why?
It's less impossible than here.
When she opened her eyes, her 2nd meal had cooled, but she didn't want it. Her disused bowels protested. She went to the toilet and strained, but voided only a trickle of urine. Feeling ill, she hunched in the dark, small space, shivering, sweat from her armpits running down her ribs. The smell of her urine mixed with the toilet's chemicals and the sweetly acrid odor of her long fast.
Pleine de la cordée de thon.
Prudeuse et noire.
Full of the acrid smell of time. Dusty and black. Baudelaire. Another world. With wonder, she felt it present itself. Consciousness was a mystery. She stared into the darkness. Fell asleep again on the pot. Again she saw Roger shackled to the metal table. A door opened, and he looked up.
"We've decided."
He waited.
"Your ship, your crew, your people, they don't exist. No one will ever know about them."
Roger was silent.
"The ones remaining here, the ones who helped you, you're thinking we can't keep them all quiet. We can. We're into your private keys. We know everyone who was involved. We'll round them up. The number's small enough. After all your work, Roger, all their years of effort, there will be nothing but a few pathetic rumors and conspiracy theories. All those good people who helped you will be disappeared forever. Like you. How does that make you feel?"
They knew the risks. For them, it was already over. Like me.
Over? Oh, Roger. We can make over last a long time.
Still, we did it. They did it. They know that.
You're not hearing me, Roger. I said we've changed that.
The ship is out there.
No. I said it's not.
Repeat after me.
Say it's not, Roger.
Buffer overflow. So that was it. Their data stream was not being received. Sophie had done much of the information theory design work. An energy-efficient system approaching Shannon's limit for channel capacity. Even from Alpha C, it would be only 10 joules per bit. The instruments collected data. Magnetometer, spectrometers, plasma analyzer, cosmic ray telescope, Cherenkov detector, etc. Data was queued in a transmit buffer and sent out more or less continuously at a low bit rate. The protocol was designed to be robust against interference, dropped packets, interstellar scintillation, and the long latencies imposed by their great distance and the speed of light. They debated even whether to carry communications.
"What's the point? We're turning our backs on them."
Roger was insistent.
"Are we scientists? This is an unprecedented chance to collect data in the heliopause, the Oort cloud, the interstellar medium, the Alpha system itself. Astronomy from Alpha, reliable distances to every star in our galaxy, that alone is huge."
"Sending back data broadcasts our location."
"So? How hard is it to follow a nuclear plasma trail to the nearest star? Anyway, they'd need a ship to follow. We have the only one."
"You say the Earth situation is terminal. Who's going to receive this data?"
"Anybody. Everybody."
So, Shackleton Crater. It was a major comm link anyway, and its site at the south pole of the moon assured low ambient noise and permanent line of sight to the ship. They had a gypsy there, one of their tribe, to receive their data. The data stream was broken up into packets to better weather the long trip home. Whenever Shackleton received a packet, it responded with an acknowledgement to confirm reception. When the ship received that axe signal, at their present distance that would be about 2 months after a packet was transmitted, the confirmed packet was removed from the transmit queue to make room for new data. Otherwise, the packet went back to the end of the queue to be retransmitted later. Packets were time-stamped, so they could be reassembled into a consecutive data stream no matter in what order they were received. But no axe signals had been received for over a year. The buffer was full. That's why she was awake. They'd known the Shackleton link could be broken, even though it had a plausible cover story of looking for SETI transmissions from Alpha C. But other gypsies on Earth should also be receiving. Someone should be acknowledging. A year of silence. Going back through the computer logs, she found there'd been an impact. 8 months ago, something had hit the ship. Why hadn't that wakened a steward? It had been large enough to get through the forward electromagnetic shield. The shield deflected small particles which over decades would erode their hull. The damage had been instantaneous. Repair geckos responded in the first minutes. Since it took most of a day to rouse a steward, there would have been no point. Maybe the impact hit the antenna array. She checked and adjusted alignment to the sun. They were okay. She took a routine spectrograph and measured the Doppler shift. 0.056C. No. Their velocity should be 0.067C. 12 years. It added 12 years to their cruising time. She studied the ship's logs as that sank in. The fusion engine had burned its last over a year ago, then was jettisoned to spare mass. Why hadn't a steward awakened before her? The computer hadn't logged any problems. Engine function read as normal. The sledge that held the fuel had been emptied one by one and discarded. All the fuel had been burned. All as planned. So absent other problems, the lower velocity alone hadn't triggered an alert. Stupid. Think. They'd begun to lag only in the last months of burn. Some ignitions had failed or underperformed. It was probably anti-proton decay in the triggers. Nothing could have corrected that. Good thinking. Nice fail. 12 years. It angered her. The impact and the low velocity directly threatened their survival, and no alarms went off. But loss of comms, that set off alarms. That was important to Roger, who was never meant to be on board. He's turned his back on humanity, but he still wants them to hear all about it. And to hell with us. When her fear receded, she was calmer. If Roger still believed in anything redeemable about humankind, it was the scientific impulse. Of course, it was primary to him that his ship do science and send data. This was her job. Why Alpha C? Why so impossibly far? Why not the moon? The U.S. was there, the base at Shackleton, with a 10,000-acre solar power plant, a deuterium mine in the lunar ice, and a 20-gigawatt particle beam. The Chinese were on the far side, mining helium-3 from the regolith. Why not Mars? China was there. A one-way mission had been sent in 2025. The crew might not have survived, that was classified, but the robotics had. The planet was reachable, and therefore dangerous. Jupiter? There were rumors that the U.S. was there as well, maybe the Chinese too, robots anyway, staking a claim to all that helium. Roger didn't put much credence in the rumors, but they might be true. Why not wait it out at a Lagrange point? Roger thought there was nothing to wait for. The situation was terminal. As things spiraled down the maelstrom, anything cislunar would be at risk. Sooner or later, any ship out there would be detected and destroyed. Or it might last only because civilization was shattered, with the survivors in some pit plotting to pummel the shards. It was Alpha C, because Roger Fry was a fanatic who believed that only an exit from the solar system offered humanity any hope of escaping what it had become. She thought of Sergei, saying in his bad accent and absent grammar, which he exaggerated for effect, "This is shit. You say me Alpha C is best? Absolute impossible. He's double star. No planet in habitable orbit. Yes, yes, whatever. Minima maxima, zone of hopeful bullshit. Ghost planet hope. You shoot load there?" How long they had argued over this. Their destination.
Gliese 581.
Impossible.
Roger, it's a rocky planet with liquid water.
That's three mistakes in one sentence. Something is orbiting the star, with a period of 13 days and a mass of two Earths and some spectral lines. Rocky, water, liquid, that's all surmise. What's for sure is it's 28 light years away, plus the star is a flare star. It's disqualified twice before we even get to the hope it's a planet part.
You don't know it's a flare star. There are no observations.
In the absence of observations, we assume it behaves like other observed stars of its class. It flares.
You have this agenda for Alpha C. You've invented these criteria to shoot down every other candidate.
The criteria are transparent. We've agreed to them. Number one, 12 light-years is our outer limit. Right there, we're down to 24 stars. For reasons of luminosity and stability, we prefer a non-variable G or K-class star. Now, we're down to 5. Alpha Centauri, Epsilon Eridani, 61 Cygni, Epsilon Indi, and Tau Ceti make the cut. Alpha is half the distance of the next nearest.
Bullshit, Roger. You have bug-up ass for your Alpha C. Why not disqualify as double, huh? Why this not shoot-down criteria?
Because we have modeled it, and we know planet formation is possible in this system, and we have direct evidence of planets in other double systems. And because I know. They ended with Alpha because it was closest. Epsilon Eridani had planets for sure, but they were better off with a closer ghost planet hope than a sure thing so far they couldn't reach it. Cosmic rays would degrade the electronics, the ship, their very cells. Every year in space brought them closer to some component's MTBF, mean time between failures. Well, they'd known they might lose Shackleton. It was even likely, just not so soon. She'd been pushing away the possibility that things had gone so badly on Earth that no one was left to reply. She remembered walking on a fire road after a conference in Berkeley. The bay, dappled sapphire and russet, thick white marine layer pushing in over the Golden Gate Bridge. Talking to Roger about Fermi's paradox. If the universe harbors life, intelligence, why haven't we seen evidence of it? Why are we alone? Roger favored what he called the mean time between failures argument. Technological civilizations simply fail, just as the components that make up their technology fail, sooner or later, for reasons as individually insignificant as they are inexorable and final. Complex systems, after a point, tend away from robustness. Okay. Any receivers on Earth will have to find their new signal. It was going to be like SETI in reverse. She had to make the new signal maximally detectable. She could do that. She could retune the frequency to better penetrate Earth's atmosphere. Reprogram the PLLs and antenna array. Use orthogonal FSK modulation across the K and X bands. Increase the buffer size. And hope for the best. 84 years to go. My God, they were barely out the front door. My God, it was lonely out here. The mission plan had been 72 years, with a predicted systems failure rate of under 20%. The Weibull curve climbed steeply after that. At 84 years, systems failure rate was over 50%. What could be done to speed them? The nuclear rocket and its fuel were for deceleration and navigation at the far end. To use it here would add, she calculated, a total of 0.0002C to their current speed, saving them all of 3 months, and leaving them no means of planetfall. They had nothing. Their cruise velocity was unalterable. All right, that's that. So find a line. Commit to it and move. Cruise at this speed for longer, decelerate later and harder. That could save a few years. They'd have to run more current through the magsail, increase its drag, push its specs. Enter the Alpha C system faster than planned, slow down harder once within it. She didn't know how to calculate those maneuvers. But someone else would. Her brain was racing now, wouldn't let her sleep. She'd been up for 3 days. These were not her decisions to make. But she was the only one who could. She wrote up detailed logs with the various options and calculations she'd made. At last, there was no more for her to do. But a sort of nostalgia came over her. She wanted, absurdly, to check her email. Really, just to hear some voice not her own. Nothing broadcast from Earth reached this far, except for the AX signals beamed directly to them from Shackleton. Shackleton was also an IPN node, connecting space assets to the Internet. For cover, the AX signals it sent to Gypsy were piggybacked on bogus Internet packets, and those had all been stored by the computer. So, in her homesick curiosity, she called them out of memory and dissected some packets that had been saved from up to a year ago. examined their broken and scrambled content like a torn, discarded newspaper, for anything they might tell her of the planet she'd never see again. Warmer-than-usual regime actively amplifies tundra thaw. Drought melt permafrost, thermokarsts methane burn wildfire giants 800 ppm. Capture hot atmospheric ridge, NOAA front-running collapse sublime asymmetric artificial trade resource loss. Weapons tensions under Islamic media policy rebels arsenal strategic counterinsurgency. And to prevent federal war law operational artillery air component to mine mountain strongholds photo recce altitudes HQ backbone. SU-35 SAMs part with high maneuverability bombardments of casualty casuistry. Hurriedly autoimmune decay derivative modern thaws in Dawn's pregnant grave shares in disgust of high-frequency trading wet cities territorial earthquake poison. Bays the chairs are empty incentives to disorder without borders. Pneumonia again antibiotic resistance travels the globe with ease. Knowing perpendicular sex dating in Knob Lick, Missouri stateroom Sweeney a tilt with cheerfully synodic weenie or restorative ministration. Glintingly away triacetate hopefully occasionally sizable interrogation nauseate. Descriptive mozzarella cosmos truly and contumacious portability. Titter supine teratologies aim a point to plaintive technocrat. Mankind is inwardly endocrine and a far romantic spaceflight. Mesial Corinth's archidiaconal or lyric satirical turtle demural. Calorific fitment Mary after sappy are inscribed up to pillwort. Idem monatomic are processed long ways. Archive titty blowjob hair fetish sex free pics Russian hardcore incest stories. Animate porn wankers Benedict Paris car motorcycle cop fetish sex toys Caesar MILF hunters when I'm found this Pokemon porn gallery fisting here is links to great her lesbian sites. Long, distant, desolate. The world she'd left forever, speaking its poison poetry of ruin and catastrophe and longing. Told her nothing she didn't already know about the corrupt destiny and thwarted feeling that had drawn humankind into the maelstrom Gypsy had escaped. She stood and walked furiously the meager length of the curved corridor, stopping at each slab, regarding the sleeping forms of her crewmates, naked in translucent bodysuits, young and fit, yet broken, like her, in ways that had made this extremity feel to them all the only chance. They gathered together for the first time on the ship after receiving Roger's signal. "We'll be fine. Not even Roger knows where the ship is. They won't be able to find us before we're gone." It was her first time in space. From the shuttle, the ship appeared a formless clutter, layers of bomb sleds, each bearing thousands of microfusion devices. Under and around them, a jacket of hydrogen tanks, shields, conduits, antennas. Two white-suited figures crawled over this maze. A hijacked hydrogen depot was offloading its cargo. Five were already aboard, retrofitting. Everything not needed for deep space had been jettisoned. Everything lacking was brought and secured. Shuttles that were supposed to be elsewhere came and went on encrypted itineraries. One shuttle didn't make it. They never learned why. So they were down to 16 crew. The ship wasn't meant to hold so many active people. The crew area was less than a quarter of the Taurus, a single room narrowed to less than 10 feet by the hibernation slabs lining each long wall. Dim, even with all the LED bays on. Darius opened champagne. Contraband. No one knew how alcohol might interact with the hibernation drugs. "To Andrew and Chungpei and Hari and Miriam, they're with us in spirit." Sometime later, the first bomb went off. The ship trembled, but didn't move. Another blast. Then another. Grudgingly, the great mass budged, like a car departing a curb, no faster at first. Fuel mass went from it and kinetic energy into it. Kinesis was gradual but unceasing. In its first few minutes, it advanced less than a kilometer. In its first hour, it moved 2,000 kilometers. In its first day, 1,000,000 kilometers. After a year, when the last bomb was expended, it would be some 2,000 astronomical units from the Earth, and Gypsy would coast on at her fixed speed for decades, a dark, silent, near-dead thing. As Sophie prepared to return to hibernation, she took stock. She walked the short interior of the Quarter Taurus, less than 20 paces end to end. The black walls, the dim LED pods, the slabs of her crewmates. Never to see her beloved mountains again, her dear sawtooth Sierra. She thought of the blue sky, and remembered a hunk of stuff she'd seen on Roger's desk, some odd kind of rock. It was about 5 inches long. You could see through it. Its edges were blurry.